I'm Lin-Manuel Miranda, and you're listening to Hard Knock Life.
Well, it's the NOC in full color, you see me? The Hard Knock Life. Comics, movies, and TV. Yeah. Pop culture with a different perspective. Watch it on your screen. Hit play, so check this.
Welcome to Hard Knock Life. I'm Keith Chow.
Hey, I'm Dominic Ma.
No Brittany this week. She is on vacation. She's taking Labor Day weekend off. So
Brittany's on vacation, bitch. I think is what the
yeah, exactly.
Slightly off color thing to say would be.
You know, shout out to she deserves it. She was holding this show down when Dominic and I were intermittently in and out of the lineup. So
yeah,
she deserves a break.
Yeah. Happy Labor Day weekend. How's it going there, Darth Keith?
Not shadowy enough, I think.
Okay. I was thinking the other day that, like, you as one of the founding people of Nerds of Color, one of the, you know, heads of this whole empire, you should have a criminal mastermind kind of code name, like, you know, Strife or Mr. Sinister or something like that. But I don't know what your supervillain name would be, or if you're to self-assign.
Yeah, let me give you some suggestions, let's say. So the Chinese characters in my name is the character for happiness, right?
Lock. Mm-hmm.
Like Phi Lock.
With my terrible Cantonese, I'm sort of following
you. You know what I'm saying, right? Like, so Lock is my Chinese name. And there was a period of time where I would go by Master Lock.
It's good.
So good. I think that could be one.
Spilled L-O-K. Okay,
yes.
Oh, that is gangster. And Master Lock, that's pretty good. And that is a good supervillain name, really.
Yeah. I used to subtitle my personal blog. Used to be, I got this blog on Lock.
Totally. And you can have the superpower of creating, like, impenetrable doors or some shit.
And
like
yet
that.
The Chinese character has nothing to do with locks, right?
Like, yeah. It's just a cross-cultural pun.
Yeah, this is about being happy. That's the word. Yeah. The word means happy in Chinese. But
yeah, it's a good one because, you know, Cantonese has some of those harsh ending sounds, the ox and the chuts and thoughts. It sounds, you know, it sounds a little mean spirited, or it sounds a little, it has force.
But it also has a bit of, like, a, you know, Star Wars Jedi's like feel, right?
Calling absolutely. And everything. Well, yeah, absolutely. And again, all the good Star Wars names being borrowed from East Asian languages. We know that's a winning combination.
Yeah. Let's see if that catches. I'm not sure if that'll catch.
Master Lock, Darth Lock, Mr. Lock?
Or you could just call me the real Chow.
But of course, then there's the Marvel guy who's actually named Deathlock.
Yeah.
Are you infringing on his?
True, because he spells it L-O-K too, doesn't he?
Yeah. Was he actually Cantonese? No.
They should recast him as an Asian American.
They should totally do Deathlock as Cantonese. He was
A-A Deathlock. Start the hashtag.
Totally. I mean, there's room there because it's less disputed territory than that whole Iron Fist nonsense. Deathlock was in Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.
That's true. He was actually African American. So they already race bent Deathlock.
Okay.
Right. Unless on. Was Deathlock a white? I'm assuming he was a white dude in the comics.
I don't know. I think he was black and for some period in the comics.
Oh, really? Okay. So it wasn't quite a race bend.
Again, for those who don't know, we're talking about Deathlock is a relatively obscure Marvel character. He's kind of a cyborg with, like, Terminator-y fancy guns.
Villain? Anti-hero? I'm not quite sure.
I'm saying an anti-hero. I didn't follow him super well, but he has really good, you know, costume and design.
I mean, he's kind of the Deathstroke Deadpool milieu, right? Like, then they all kind of come out at the same time.
He is. He's like, we did
Deadshot, another one of those kind of.
Yeah.
All look
right. Something like Deadpool is Deathstroke. To Deathstroke as Deathlock is to Deadshot.
Yes.
Or something
I
like,
think that's the proper analogy. Line,
yeah. But yeah, no, yeah, we should totally do that. Guy is a Cantonese character.
He's the original. So. Well, that's why I'm the real Chow. He's the real Lock, I guess.
For real.
Well, speaking of Marvel, let's start with the most recent episode of She-Hulk that's pissed off a lot of dudes on the internet for some reason. I wonder why this episode rubbed dudes the wrong way. And dudes
full of rage. So ironic.
They all turned green and started smashing.
Yeah, I'm having a green fruit shake to commemorate this, but yes.
In a purple glass, no less. No.
That would have been better.
That would have. So yes, the most recent episode of She-Hulk, episode 3, finds Emil Blonsky's parole trial, but also there's a B plot where, speaking of DC characters, the guy who played Vigilante on Arrow plays the lawyer Pug, who's defending the other like douchebag lawyer from episode 1.
Oh, okay. Not the guy who played Vigilante in
not the funny Vigilante Peacemaker. No, he was he didn't actually play Vigilante on Arrow. I think he was like the Dark Archer or something. I don't know. I didn't watch enough Arrowverse shows.
Okay.
But he was Adrian Chase, who was supposed to be Vigilante. Anyway, he's defending against some shape-shifting Asgardian elf who defrauded a dude claiming she was Megan Thee Stallion, which sets up some great comedy later in the episode. Anyway, so that's episode 3. The piece that I think pissed a lot of dudes on the internet, which is kind of like, you know, copyright trademark dudes on the internet, was this great bit somewhere in the middle of the episode where they kind of show a bunch of like YouTube comments and tweets from people saying basically like why She-Hulk gotta be, why do like the MCU is all like girls or whatever, like
yes
which was really great, because it's essentially they were just copy and pasting actual comments from when She-Hulk was announced.
Yes, weirdly enough, that part was totally realistic. Weirdly enough, that is the part that actually writes itself.
Quite literally. Yeah, it's also quite ironic that the episode of Hard Knock Life, where it's just two dudes, get to talk about this particular episode of She-Hulk.
Yeah, we're talking about it. In fact, we might even explain something. But yeah, no, do you want to tackle that part first? Because I mean, I've been thinking about sort of the you know, the feminist project involved in She-Hulk and some of the themes they're trying to get across. And that part was, you know, particularly blatant because, as you said, it was just kind of cut and pasting comments that we've seen in actual life.
Right.
You know, that in that case, the variation is on how come there aren't any Asian superheroes? Why don't you make your own? It's like, well, you
know, right.
We do. And then you don't like them for other reasons. But a silly recursive argument. I do wonder if that is sort of, you know, low hanging fruit, as it were, just sort of mocking, parodying like commenters on the internet. But I think it is cool, given the fourth wall breaking nature of the story, that it gets to be in dialogue with the actual phenomenon of the MCU as a fan experience,
right?
And what we're talking about every week.
And it makes the most sense for that blatant a satire to be in this show, right? Yeah, like it would be really weird if like Jessica Jones had a scene where she's scrolling through comments about like sexist dudes on the internet, but it makes sense here because, again, the things that they were saying, like, was like, I mean, I'm not saying that the writers literally copy and paste it, but it was the same kind of commentary, right? And also a lot of guys like telling on themselves because they were like assuming She-Hulk was derivative of like the MCU Hulk, where like She-Hulk is an actual comic character. You know what I'm saying? Like they kind of forgot that they were adapting her. It was almost like, why do you have to gender bend the Hulk when She-Hulk is an actual character in the comics? You know what I mean?
Yeah, and that's what those trolls do. They speak from misinformed, non-informed point of anger, knee-jerk anger. Yeah, She-Hulk's been around a while. Captain Marvel's been a woman for a while.
Right.
Yeah, it's funny you mentioned Jessica Jones. I was just thinking about that in terms of, you know, just in the larger sense of how our world is falling apart. Like Jessica Jones had a lot of powerful feminist messages too, a lot of powerful feminist themes. And to my mind, like, well, wonderfully executed in just, especially in seasons 1 and 3, just still one of the best written things Marvel's ever done. I don't remember if there was as much calamity or internet trolling about it at the time. Maybe that's just a function of the time. It was, you know, whatever it was, like 2014 and not 2022. And people didn't like, you know, obsess over every little thing that's happened in the Marvel universe.
But, you know, I will say too, I've seen some kind of like whataboutism when it comes to like the kind of discourse around She-Hulk, particularly like the celebration of its feminist themes. And some of the whataboutism is like, well, why didn't they do the same thing for Jessica Jones?
Why didn't they do the same
thing? Why wasn't there the same kind of like celebratory, like, look how feminist these shows are?
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, yeah, that's what I'm low-key saying, is they have already done this. This is not the first.
Right. But I also think the difference is shows like Agent Carter and Jessica Jones, for whatever it's worth, and this gets into the, some of the like corporate Kevin Feige, what's Marvel Studios. Those shows didn't have the backing of Marvel Studios proper.
Hmm.
You know what I'm saying? Like the reason She-Hulk is such a big deal, or any of these Disney Plus shows, these are officially part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. We're like Mark Ruffalo and Benedict Wong and Tim Roth, characters from previous Marvel films get to interact with these characters. Whereas however they faint towards actual connection to the MCU, both Agent Carter and Jessica Jones and all of the Netflix shows and all the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., which we talked about earlier, there wasn't the same kind of like hype and reinforcement behind those shows that the Disney Plus shows get, you know?
But yeah, and but I'd also argue, and then we're going back in the time machine here, but they were... because they were paving the way. They were experimental at the time. They were the streaming Marvel show, and there weren't others, okay? There was, I mean, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., yeah, was kind of around, but they were testing this thing out. We got this movie thing on lock. We just did the Avengers. Oh my God. They were kind of like, whoa, we pulled that off. Now can we do this streaming binge TV series that everything's talking about? It was very like testing the waters. And to me, a wonderful success. Daredevil, Luke Cage, Jessica Jones.
That other show.
That other one. But that the only point of that is to say they did carve an important path for this veritable onslaught of binging shows that we have now.
And the irony, of course, is Daredevil is going to make an appearance on She-Hulk eventually.
Yeah, as he must.
So
maybe in the yellow suit, which is funny, but...
And it's not out of bounds, perhaps, for Kristen Ritter to show up again in...
I thought she was gonna, because she's in that category that they call the street level heroes.
Right. Yeah. And you know, like, again, they're paving the way with the reintroduction of Vincent D'Onofrio and Charlie Cox into the MCU proper.
Yeah.
However, they're connected to their original Netflix shows can be debated, but that paves the way for Kristen Ritter, for the other actors from the Netflix shows to show up again in the MCU. But the other question is, like, is that something you want, right? Does the tone of Jessica Jones and the Daredevil shows fit with the MCU? Because that's kind of the controversy of bringing back Kingpin and Daredevil.
Mm-hmm.
And even the announcement of the Daredevil Born Again series is that, like,
yeah,
is this really season four, or is this like kind of ignoring what came before and kind of recanonizing a different story from Matt Murray? I mean, I don't, at the end of the day, I don't think it matters ultimately, but it matters to like nerds. I think for like general audience, people who watched Daredevil on Netflix, they're going to go, oh, look, it's another season of Daredevil. And I don't think there's going to be any kind of like confusion, but there is something to be said about, are these really the characters? I know that Brittany talks about all the time. D'Onofrio says, well, I'm playing Wilson Fisk as if he's the same Wilson Fisk, but.
Well, it matters somewhat in terms of basically tone and direction of the shows. And like, you know, tone is an overused word, but what it mean was, I mean, bringing back to She-Hulk, the Daredevil and Jessica Jones existed in a whole different, what would you call it? Well, definitely a different viewer rating.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, different content.
I mean, Disney Plus had to introduce parent restrictions when they brought those shows over, you know.
Exactly. The shows are adult, they're dark, they have very, very wrong adult humor, some very, very transgressive humor. I'll say Jessica Jones incredibly funny, but for adults, not funny for
kids. But that's the thing, like, if Born Again is not TVMA, is that going to be a problem?
It will be, in the sense that Daredevil was an achievement of writing and directing and finding that certain voice. And if it becomes, well, lighthearted, I'm not going to say kiddie style, because that's not, you know, that's not the whole thing. But if it becomes lighthearted, it's questionable. Because, you know, getting back to She-Hulk, because I was watching this episode, I thought it came into its own as, oh, this is a lighthearted legal comedy in the vein of Ally McBeal, which apparently was a show that none of the writers in the writer's room were old enough to remember, according to an interview with Jessica Gao. But that's fine. They're still doing that Ally McBeal thing. And I, you know, for all this talk about the casting, I thought that the lead actor totally came into her own as that sort of, you know, flustered, funny sitcom lawyer type.
Right.
In this episode, I think those things gelled, if that makes any sense. You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and for what it's worth, whether or not they're old enough to remember Ally McBeal, they're aware enough to add an Ally McBeal Easter egg in this episode, because I think the TV in the bar is playing an episode of Ally McBeal. So there's a bit of an Ally McBeal Easter egg in this episode.
Yeah, totally.
The thing about She-Hulk is that, and they've said this from jump, that they're going to lean into the comedy aspect. I mean, Jessica Gao, let's not forget, she was one of the executive producers of Rick and Morty. She is a comedy person first. So right. Having her show run She-Hulk, of course, it's going to be comedic. And I think it's as much as like WandaVision kind of celebrated the sitcom format. Mm-hmm. And there's always been like a comedic element to the MCU. I mean, hell, the Russo brothers being such a driving force for the MCU coming from Arrested Development and Community, you know. The comedy format, the sitcom format, has always been baked in the DNA of the Marvel Cinematic Universe. So just this is it in its like fully realized form, essentially.
Yeah. So it all came together, especially with, you know, fourth wall breaking nods to the A story and the B story. You know, that stuff is a little too cute for me, but it's fun. It contributes to the lighthearted atmosphere. This is not so terribly serious. Okay, so wait. So which case would you rather talk about first? The A story or the B story, since I said that?
I feel like that's a good point, because the B story wasn't that important, but the B story is the other like online discourse, because not only was the elf imitating Megan Thee Stallion, but Megan Thee Stallion makes an actual cameo in the episode itself, and of course, and it's very talked about post-credit scene.
Yeah, totally.
So, I mean, again, I think that's great. I don't understand people's kind of like backlash against like having like the celebrity show up in a whether it's a movie or a television. That's kind of like a well-worn trope too. You know, yeah. Like the celebrity cameo.
And especially it's Megan Thee Stallion. And I mean, I am not in a position to speak intelligently about Megan Thee Stallion.
Right. We're too old. Again, this is where this episode of Hard Knock Life fails, having not a person younger than 40 be on this particular episode.
I do not have that nerd knowledge, but I appreciate that she's in the show.
Yeah.
To me, it's kind of unexpected. Maybe she likes Marvel stuff. Maybe she seems a little bit too cool, honestly, to be amongst all these superheroes. But it was great. It's the kind of thing that makes that joke a joke.
Yeah.
A successful, you know what I mean?
Right. It's one thing to just name check her and then that's it. But to have her actually show up in the courtroom, you know, that's some comedy right there. And it works as a bit, and it works for the episode.
Yeah. And it was really a funny setup. As far as sitcom plots go, it was a funny setup. It has all these dimensions. Elf impersonating famous black woman celebrity to get the douchey guy to hook up with, you know, whether or not the douchey guy could really believe that it's Megan Thee Stallion or not. They actually could have milked that for more comedy,
right?
Because it's so absurd. I think they might have hit a ceiling and like with having to do the superhero stuff and the other story. I at some point, it might as well be now, I should give a shout out to my cousin Stephanie, who is actually a lawyer and is actually one of the people who listen to this podcast. And she is a lawyer occasionally for the government, and she, so she gave me, you know, little notes and comments about the She-Hulk episode, because she likes She-Hulk too.
Oh, great.
You know, one thing she said, and I'll just quote verbatim about that elf story, was the was that in retrospect, the light elf case went pretty fast. I wouldn't have brought that diplomatic immunity defense, which I thought was funny. She was really overanalyzing.
Well, let me shout out Stephanie real quick, because the diplomatic immunity thing didn't make any sense when the judge dismissed it, because he said that might work in New Asgard, but we're not in New Asgard. But isn't the whole point of diplomatic immunity is that when you're not in your home country, you're immune to the laws of the country you're in? Isn't that what diplomatic immunity means?
I think so, but I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah, me either. But that kind of like tripped me up a second.
Well, okay. Well, they got away with one.
Yeah, that didn't make sense. So, you know, I think Stephanie is right, is all I'm saying in that.
Yeah, no, good analysis, cousin. And I mean, the other funny thing about this was that she also wrote a fanfic which contains a lot of these themes. There was set in the legal setting, and there's a shape-shifting Japanese creature, and also Loki shows up because Loki's her favorite.
Right.
So if you're tooling around archive of our own, I believe her screen name is Cardio Junkie, which I'm not sure if she actually is a cardio junkie, but I believe Cardio Junkie wrote this thing called Murder Club.
Nice.
Which has a whole bunch of the themes that are in this actual She-Hulk episode now. And I just point that out because, you know, the zeitgeist, these things are.
Yeah, absolutely. Around. Well, here, let me ask a question too, Stephanie, if you're listening. Because as we mentioned, Daredevil is primed to have a cameo appearance, or probably even a bigger appearance than just a cameo. And I know that, like, when this show was announced, a lot of people were hoping for a Daredevil appearance because, like, hey, they're both lawyers.
Yeah.
But they're also both defense attorneys. So, like, it's not like they're going to, like, go up against one another.
Well, that's technically interesting. You're right. Didn't think about that. They mainly defend people.
Yeah.
Defenders.
Right.
No, wait. Wait, in the very first case of She-Hulk, is she not prosecuting somebody?
Well, she wasn't the DA.
She's the DA. She's the DA.
And that's then she right. got hired. It made sense when people were speculating. But now that the show's out and she went from the DA's office to be the superhero defense attorney.
Right.
She can't actually go up against Daredevil unless he's the defendant.
I'm sure the answer is somewhere in the comics was somehow they got them opposed to each other.
Right.
Anyway, I mean,
maybe
sure
she's a prosecutor in the comics. Because I don't think she's a superhero defense attorney in the comics.
Or maybe also they don't care about that stuff. And
yeah,
who cares? Comics writing. Maybe they're just, like, they're both lawyers. We don't care about that. But yeah, no, the thing, the defenders versus the prosecutors is very it's very important to alignment, skill set, all that stuff. But yeah, no, we're pretty sure. I mean, Daredevil does show up in the, you know, in the trailer for She-Hulk. So he's going to show up.
Yeah, definitely.
Maybe when he's in the red costume, Daredevil's a defense attorney, but when he's in the yellow costume,
he's a prosecutor.
Works for the prosecution.
Yeah, maybe. I'm sure that's how it works.
Yeah, that's clear to me.
Yeah, I should have thought about that. Well, let's flip over to the A story. Let's connect to the A story.
Yes.
Where
nice.
Jennifer's defending, or I guess not defending, but she's at Emil Blonsky's parole board hearing. I love Wong's appearance in this episode. Yeah, that's another one that was teased in the trailers, but it was really funny. So here are my favorite bits of Wong's appearance in this particular episode. I loved his LinkedIn profile, where he was not only Sorcerer Supreme and a librarian at Kamar-Taj. Apparently, he was also a Target associate, which I love. I wanted the episode of the Kamar-Taj Target, just like sorcerers wandering around the aisles.
Yeah.
Because we're assuming it's like a sorceress only Target, right? Like,
oh no, I think it's just like a place where they go to get bathroom tissue and toothpaste and stuff. Like, I bet it's just as useful and generic as every Target everywhere in the world.
Oh, okay.
But I don't know. Maybe it's a super Target. Maybe it's super magic Target. I don't know.
Super Target. Super Targets do exist too. So there's that.
Oh right, the super Target.
I also loved how once Wong, first of all, he's late to the hearing, which was great. But once he arrives and admits that I did break out Blonsky and was told, oh, that's also a federal offense. He's like, oh, I got to go now.
Yeah, that was smooth. Good job, Wong. And yeah, love to talk about Wong. We should give Wong some love. I almost did the, should give Wong some love. Okay, for one thing, he briefly explains that plot point of what happened in Shang-Chi, right?
Kind of, still doesn't make a lot of sense.
Is that the first time it's even been mentioned why that was happening?
Yeah,
I'm not saying it's the best explanation, but
because he says the reason why is that he was training to be Sorcerer Supreme.
Yeah.
Let me poke a couple holes in that though. Because he's already Sorcerer Supreme. He doesn't have to train to become Sorcerer Supreme.
No, but I think somewhere in the timeline at that point he wasn't quite yet. Him becoming Sorcerer Supreme has happened somewhere between Shang-Chi and
No Way Home, Strange says he's Sorcerer Supreme on a technicality because I blipped away for 5 years. So he's been the Sorcerer Supreme for the last 5 years.
Well, yeah, but he still has to do the training things. It's like, I mean, he has to do proficiency tests.
But then we also know in Shang-Chi, there's more to this because we know in Shang-Chi, those were not fair fights. Remember he tells Blonsky, like, hey, you were supposed to pull your punch and he didn't, right? So like these are fixed fights, so there's something more to it than just simply training.
Seems like what you're saying is that by this theory Wong had to do his proficiency test to become Sorcerer Supreme and he cheated on at least one of them, which is not unheard of.
Yeah,
but okay, if I'm getting this right, yes, he has to fight a worthy opponent. For some reason he has to bring him to this special octagon cage match in Macau, but he doesn't perhaps to make it public and to make a good show of it.
Yeah.
But little does everyone know, little does the, you know, Council of Convertage know or whatever, that he just paid the guy to take a fall.
Right.
So he could, wow, that's scandalous, Wong. That's a little tricky.
Or the whole thing is pro wrestling.
Here's the part where we're Chinese guys, so we can say this.
Well, yeah, exactly. Yeah,
but no, we love Wong, and he is the Sorcerer Supreme, and
I hope he keeps that title. Let me eat a little crow, because last week I said the seven soulmates are the Thunderbolts. Clearly.
Yeah, good call, Keith.
Yeah, I was wrong.
but good idea. That was still good.
No, Julie Louis-Dreyfus cameo to prove that theory correct. It was, he's starting a cult when he gets out. He's starting like a Mormon concubine when he gets out of prison.
And honestly, that shit is a little creepy. Like, for me, I'm not trying to be sensitive. That's the part where, like, it might look like a funny joke on paper. But to me, actually, that, like, looks real weird, because there are precedents in real life. Yeah, cults of all women started by guys
creepy
in jail.
Dudes.
Yeah, that's funny for 1 second, and then it actually happens, and then whoa. So that was an example of what I thought was not its most successful joke.
Yeah,
very good. And I would have, you know, it would have been cool if they were Thunderbolts, but I
right. Well, and it could still happen. There's still time for the Thunderbolts to
yeah.
I mean, that's the big closer to Phase 5, so.
Yeah.
Thunderbolts have to be.
They got to start seeding that somehow. I mean, I did. So getting back to the wrestling thing, I do think they're being primed to be in these superpowered wrestling federation, which still hasn't shown up yet. I'm holding out to hope that's the purpose of the seven sisters or whatever they're called, because they all get, you know, injected with formula, and then they're all super strong. And then again, we need Nate to get in on the
right
on the wrestling.
Speaking of the super wrestling, but that could be the other explanation for the fight in Macau, that the whole thing is staged. It's like a Vince, like Ronnie Ching is basically Vince McMahon, and none of those fights are
right. That's good
fights. So
that brings that WWE-ish element together with the Camartage storyline,
right?
And that gets really funny. Man, we're with you, Marvel. We're trying to
make it work.
Stuff out with you.
Gotta make it work.
Okay, I think Roth is doing a really good job inhabiting a comedic turn, reminiscent of what's his face in Iron Man 2.
Yeah.
That's another connection we have to mention in news. But
yes, Ben Kingsley is not done with the MCU.
Yeah, let's just talk about that one right now, because I'm saying Tim Roth, good job, good sitcom thing. But do we want to talk about the?
Yeah, go for it. We're in the Marvel segment, right? So I guess they announced a Wonder Man show. I don't remember Wonder Man actually being announced to begin with.
I think that was a joke we made two months ago about,
like, they don't make a show for anybody in the MCU.
Yeah. But
it was officially announced that Ben Kingsley's coming back as Trevor Slattery.
Right.
In Wonder Man.
Right. Because he was also, you know, an actor playing a part in Iron Man 2.
Right.
And so the whole, you know, basic thing about Wonder Man, he's like this stunt performer, actor, LA guy, who happens to be super strong and invulnerable, so he can do all these movie stunts. So he'd be very much in the LA world, entertainment industry world, probably with the Mandarin actor, probably with Trevor, and with She-Hulk, who's also in the LA world. So there's some, you know, there's
connective tissue
there. Connective tissue there, yeah. Although it is funny, I like Wonder Man is like they really are getting to the bottom of the West Coast Avengers roster here. Like even I find it hard to find love for Wonder Man. I fucking love Moon Knight, and you know, like, people are like, who the fuck is Moon Knight? I fucking love Moon Knight. That tier.
Did you love the show?
No, I did not love the show, but I love the character of Moonlight, and he's like D tier Marvel, F tier, right, whatever.
At
I think
best.
Wonder Man is
below
several,
that,
for me, several tiers below that.
That doesn't but again, mean it be that a was Rocket show, Raccoon. But like, no one gave a shit about Rocket Raccoon before the Guardian.
But he's a raccoon, so it's a gimme. No, we see that like some of the special characters can rise to other things. But again, the problem is Wonder Man is really just a man.
Right,
he's a bulky white dude who's like, he begs another angle or a race bent casting.
You know,
at core, he's the most normal kind of Chad.
They haven't cast him yet, right? Because I think when I see Wonder Man, and this is no knock against the dude, because I love the guy, he's a friend, but I see Louis Tan as a really cool Wonder Man.
Sure, sure.
Primarily because I wanted him to be Johnny Cage in the Mortal Kombat movies, and he's
right,
not.
Right.
Because it made, to me, it made sense. Instead, they created some new character for him in the Mortal Kombat movies. But when Lewis was cast as the lead of Mortal Kombat, I was like, oh, he's got to be Johnny Cage, like the LA guy, the actor, stuntman who is egotistical and becomes this martial arts superstar. I kind of feel like that's the same vibe for Wonder Man.
Oh, yeah. Johnny Cage, very, very Wonder Man vibe.
Like, I think Lewis, I mean, and Lewis had a brush with, you know, he was supposedly up for Iron Fist, and it's a good way to bring him back in the Marvel fold.
That's good. That's good.
He can play the egotistical LA guy.
Ironic. Yeah, he could. Yeah, he could rock that Wonder Man role. And again, that means we could get folks, we're at the Asian American agenda part of the podcast. We could start a whole new podcast campaign, whole new hashtag social media campaign for an Asian American Wonder Man, which no one has ever asked for, but also maybe no one would care about.
Right. No, there's going to be no pushback for the AA Wonder Man campaign.
Right. Guarantee. And it would be.
But cool, then again, I thought there'd be no pushback for the AA Iron Fist campaign. And what do I know?
Yeah. Who knows anything? Right. But yeah, there, the special problem was there was the Asian loop of, do you want the Asian guy just doing stereotypical Asian things or not? Not to rehash the whole thing.
Right.
Rehash. But Wonder Man, it would be cool. You could get to talk about, you know, Asian American stuff in Hollywood, masculinity stuff.
Yeah.
I'm just going to say right now, I think that would make Wonder Man a much more interesting series.
Because he's not that interesting, right? Well, and then, you know, Trevor Slattery's got the history with the Asian part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe anyway, since he hangs out in Ta-Lo.
Yes.
So it all makes sense if they make Asian American Wonder Man.
Yes. Can we just talk for a minute about the Wrecking Crew?
Yes. That's who they were supposed to be, right? Because their weapons mimicked. About F-tier Marvel characters.
Well, that's the interesting question. What tier are the Wrecking Crew on? Because, Keith, you know, for my comics experience, okay, so anyway, context, the Wrecking Crew shows up at the end of She-Hulk episode 3, and she fights them and beats them easily. From my comic experience, the Wrecking Crew are like the cannon fodder of the Marvel Universe, and like everyone kind of fights them at one point or other. Just like whenever you need like a generic supervillain, like robbing a bank or something, it's like the Wrecking Crew. Like the Avengers fights them every 3 weeks. They
aren't they imbued with like Asgardian superpowers or something? Yes. In the comics, right?
Yes, they are. And that was
because she said, like, what did you rip off, like an Asgardian like weapons depot or something?
And right. So that was ridiculously faithful. They were actually a crew of construction workers. Shout out on Labor Day weekend
to the evil construction workers.
To the wrecking crew. No, because I'll get more on that point later. But as far as the comic origin, they're a crew of construction workers, and somehow their tools get empowered with the same magical stuff as Thor's hammer. So super crowbar, super wrecking ball. And so there's these four dudes, and they are lower tier because they're kind of like stupid. They're just like goons. But they are always brought on like to fight the A-list people whenever they need the generic villain of the week.
You need a jobber.
So they're B-list in that way. And they were like, and they were part of the supervillains crew that was summoned for Secret Wars 1. That was when I was first introduced to them. Everyone else in, well, I'm getting really deep here. But in the start of Secret Wars, you know, they get the A-list superhero crew and the A-list supervillain crew. And everyone in the A-list supervillain crew is like Dr. Doom or Dr. Octopus or Galactus or Ultron, people we really know. And then they're the Wrecking Crew just filling it out. They're technically Thor villains, but I don't think we'd call them, like, Loki's obviously the big Thor antagonist. They're just some guys that show up occasionally in Thor or Spider-Man or whoever beats them down. So anyway, circling back to the actual She-Hulk episode, it was funny that they showed up as sort of the most innocuous random dudes who are easily beaten up in like her first, one of her first legitimate superhero fights. So I know. So that was kind of, that made me happy on several levels.
Yeah, absolutely. I love the gag where she like forgot she was She-Hulk for a second. I was like, oh yeah, that's right.
Yeah, that was a really good gag. Yeah, that was a perfect moment. But I will say I was a little disappointed that they seemed like
teenagers.
Like young random dudes who had happened upon to some, you know, super construction stuff. Like sort of in my perfect world, again, with respect to Labor Day. They would have been like real construction work. They would have been dudes with real working class jobs who lucked onto these magical tools.
Which is kind of like Vulture's crew in Spider-Man, right? Like that would have been a good setup for
more
the
like
crew.
Those dudes.
Because
those
they dudes were they were all just like Spider-Man villains, though, right? Because one of them turned out to be Shocker, and one turned out to be another villain.
I forget. Yeah, Shocker and Tigger, but they had more of a story there.
Right.
I mean, you know, that working crew is probably going to come back because they made reference to someone behind,
like Big Boss, and I think that's the big speculation: who's the big boss that they reference? Yeah. Is it Kingpin? Mm. Is it Sharon Carter? Because it's always Sharon Carter apparently nowadays.
Oh wow! If it would, that would be deep.
Before we close out the Marvel section of the pot, speaking of Spider-Man, do you know what the number one movie in the country is?
Please tell me.
It's Spider-Man No Way Home, the more fun edition.
Dope.
Or I think it's Spider-Man : No Way Home, : the more fun edition. Apparently it's even though Spider-Man is on Blu-ray to own, they re-release it in theaters with 11 additional minutes and a whole new post-credit sequence.
Yeah. How about
that? I take it you didn't go see it.
No, I heard about that, but did you go
see it? I did not go see it again. I read about it. I did not go see it because I own the Blu-ray and I didn't feel like going to a movie theater to see 10 more minutes of a movie that I own on Blu-ray.
Yeah, when I saw that, I mean, my first thought was, yeah, the movie theater industry is still in trouble, right?
I mean, because it's the number one movie with like $6 million, which typically is not number one movie material, but it is nowadays.
I mean, this is still a big, broad issue in our, you know, pop culture entertainment discourse. And a lot of things are coming back from our big pandemic problem. Movie theaters are still in a weird way. I think most things have been underperforming from our previous standard. And yeah, so you do things like bring back the Spider-Man movie from whatever it is 8 months ago.
Right.
And a lot of people would argue, oh, great. Now they're just, I guess... There's the camp that worries that movie theaters will just mean Marvel theaters.
Marvel movie, right.
And all the beautiful independent movies that we used to treasure in the 90s and follow are going to have an even harder road than...
Or they just go straight to streaming.
Right, which is not bad as an alternative. Yeah. So there's that. I don't know, what do you think about that?
There's a lot of talk about the mid-budget movie kind of going away, the adult drama. But those movies actually probably get a bigger audience by going straight to streaming than they ever got in like theaters. The problem with not putting them in theaters is those great independent one screen cinemas in your neighborhood don't have them to screen anymore. And that's what's terrible about not having those, like, you know, art house indie cinemas.
Right. And on the ground, those movie theaters are just dying. Those movie theaters are
like,
just
if
gone.
They're even around anymore.
Right. And their cruel choice might be, do I show this beautiful independent movie or do I try to survive as a business by showing Spider-Man for the 8,000th time?
Well, that's what made Everything Everywhere All at Once such a special film this year. Because
for sure.
That was the indie movie that just chugged along for the majority of the year.
Yeah. And that was such a feel-good story, but I think wrapped up in that is like it didn't change the tide.
Right. Yeah.
Like, the tide is.
Who knows? Maybe the silver lining and we went 45 minutes or so without mentioning David Zaslav and HBO Max and Warner Brothers Discovery, but maybe that's the silver lining in his whole approach, right? Because he's like, no more streaming movies, only movies in theaters. Does that mean is he going to put mid-budget? I mean, there's the even though there's a lot of like controversy and bad press behind it, the Don't Worry, Darling, which is the Harry Styles, Florence Pugh movie directed by Olivia Wilde, which in previous years would be considered, I think, the mid-budget adult thriller, is getting a big, you know, movie theater push.
Yeah.
Again, filled with a bunch of controversy and negative discourse because of like Shia LaBeouf and all that stuff. Yeah. But I mean, maybe Warner Brothers is going to put its money where its mouth is and reinvigorate the movie theater going experience.
That would be kind of a hardline approach. That's very interesting. Really think about it. And again, I'm the guy who doesn't care so much if
I'm the guy stream who everything
thinks,
what's
who thinks this was phasing
you're
out
the reason
naturally.
HBO Max is going to die because you're like, why not put every movie on streaming? And HBO Max was like, yes, Dominic, we hear you. And now
HBO Max heeded my wishes in that way,
right? And then they got sold to Discovery because of that decision, and now we're in the mess we're anyway.
HBO Max, release Batgirl in summer of next year, if you're listening.
Yeah, clearly they are.
If I have these coercive powers on you, because I want to see that one.
Yes.
But yeah, okay, yeah, Spider-Man again. Some new footage. Yeah, that's the part where Spider-Man becomes the villain. And it's sad to say. but it's an arc and part of every hero's arc.
Yeah. Well, and you know, there is you mentioned street level heroes. Like I read somewhere a couple weeks ago that like part of the plan for Spider-Man in the MCU going forward is that he'll be more of a street level hero, which makes sense because that's mm-hmm. what he's supposed to be in the comics. He's not usually going up against galactic threats in the comics on a regular basis, so
yeah,
perhaps he becomes more of a street level. And that is the one thing that I did read about the big change, is that, you know, if you saw No Way Home in the theater, the post-credit sequence was just the trailer for Multiverse of Madness, mm-hmm. which wouldn't make sense now because Multiverse of Madness is also streaming and mm-hmm. available on Blu-ray, so it doesn't make sense to put that as the post-credit sequence. So they added a new one. I don't know if it was newly filmed or it was just on the cutting room floor and they added later, which kind of gives some more context to exactly how people forgot about Peter Parker. And it's not just like, because I think we speculated when the movie came out, do you just like look back and you don't recognize him? In actuality, like he is physically removed from like photographs. Like there is no Peter Parker in the yearbook. Because they're doing like Betty Brant comes up and she's doing like an end of year thing on screen. You know, she's got her high school news show. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, here looking back at our high school years, and they show the field trip to DC in Homecoming, and there's no Peter Parker. They show the year trip and he's not there in the group shot. So he's been physically removed from even people's photographs of Peter Parker. That's how the spell worked.
That's pretty harsh, dude.
Yeah. So it's not like you forgot his, like you just can't place his name with a face. He's completely gone from even physical objects and people's memory.
Well, I mean, that's a very strong cliffhanger. So, I mean, yeah, I guess we will see more.
We'll see how that plays out.
Yeah.
Well, let's take a break. And on the other side of the break, Dominic and I will reveal that we have a very big high fantasy blind spot in our pop culture knowledge, since two of the biggest shows that debuted on HBO Max and Amazon Prime, Lord of the Rings and Game of Thrones, House of the Dragon, racked up like 40 million viewers. And Dominic and I are not two of them.
We've just time during the break to read the TLDR.
Yeah, exactly.
But we're not even going to do that. Anyway.
Guess what? Goalie Nutrition is sponsoring Hard Knock Life, and you can go to goalie.com to buy apple cider vinegar gummies, their ashwagandha gummies, super fruit gummies, and super greens gummies. And you get 10% off plus free shipping if you use the code HARDKNOCK at goalie.com. This is honestly, I've been taking the Goalie gummies now for a couple weeks, and I have to say, they're tasty and they're good for you. Have you guys been enjoying the Goalie gummies?
I really like them. They're yummy, but it's a nice to add to my like routine of already, like I normally take just straight vitamin C, so it's nice to have like extra supplements.
For a long time, people have praise the benefits of apple cider vinegar, and you know, as someone who's had to like drink straight apple cider vinegar sometimes when I'm not feeling well, or you know, I have some joint pain and your mom is like, drink some apple cider vinegar, it's not the most appetizing home remedy, let's just say.
No, right. It tastes horrible.
So, like the apple cider part is like, ooh, does it taste like apple cider? And it's like, no, it tastes like vinegar. But ACV is very good for you, and the fact that Goalie has been able to put the ACV into these tasty little gummies made with pectin and fruit peels, which make them vegan, which is cool. So if you're vegan, you can still rock these gummies, because everyone knows gummies are usually made out of like gelatin and nasty shit. These are made out of complete non-GMO, gelatin-free, gluten-free, vegan ingredients, and you can get the benefits, all of the benefits of apple cider vinegar taking these tasty, delicious, convenient gummies. So go to goalie.com and use the code HARDKNOCK, that's HARDNOC, just like the podcast you're listening to. Get 10% off your purchase of Goalie products and free shipping.
It's a much better delivery device for that apple cider vinegar.
Yeah.
These Goalie gummies are great. You get it and it's a delicious little candy. And I've been enjoying the super fruits one. I did feel kind of refreshed after taking a few of those.
Yeah, no, but I'm loving them so far. And they're definitely tasty. If you just want tasty gummies, at least just eat them for the yummiest.
Yeah. So go to goalie.com, use the code HARDKNOCK, HARDNOC, get 10% off your purchase and free shipping at goalie.com with the code HARDKNOCK. HARDKNOCK Life is being sponsored by Athletic Greens. I want to talk to you about Athletic Greens. With one delicious scoop of AG1, you're absorbing 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food-sourced superfoods, probiotics, and adaptogens to help you start your day right. This special blend of ingredients supports your gut health, your nervous system, your immune system, your energy, recovery, focus, and aging. Basically all the things. One of the best things about Athletic Greens is that it's lifestyle-friendly, whether you eat keto, paleo, vegan, dairy-free, or gluten-free. It also contains less than 1 gram of sugar and no GMOs, no nasty chemicals or artificial anything, and it still tastes good. Athletic Greens uses the best of the best products based on the latest science with constant product iterations and third-party testing. Right now, it's time to reclaim your health and arm your immune system with convenient daily nutrition. It's just one scoop in a cup of water every day, that's it. No need for a million different pills or supplements to look out for your health. And to make it easy, Athletic Greens is partnering with Hard Knock Media to give you a free 1 year supply of immune supporting vitamin D and 5 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/emerging. That's athleticgreens.com/emerging to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. And we're back. You know what else is back? Game of Thrones and Lord of the Rings is back.
Wait, let me take 2 minutes to decide what those things would be titled. Would it be Throne of Dragons?
Close.
Would it be Game of Dudes on Horses? No. Am I close to the dragon thing?
Kind of close. Well, that's the interesting thing. Like, they've reinvigorated these two mega franchises on HBO Max and Prime Video, respectively. But they're also both prequels. House of the Dragon takes place 200 years before the events of Game of Thrones. Rings of Power takes place like thousands of years before Lord of the Rings. So these are prequels series. And we know how effective prequels are or can be to IP. I'll just say this. I mean, I know that a lot of people love both series, and I've tried really hard to give them my full attention. I've watched the first two episodes of House of the Dragon. By the time this podcast post, there will be a third episode. I may or may not have watched. Lord of the Rings launched this week with two episodes on Prime Video, and I've gotten like 10 minutes into the first one, and I can't make it past that 10 minutes. I keep falling asleep. This is no knock against the actors and the creators of these shows. I think what I'm realizing is that high fantasy is just diminishing returns for me. It's not my bag, I think. Because I know some of the criticism of both House of the Dragon and Rings of Power that people are, you know, speaking against it because they've had the temerity to cast black people in those shows because, you know, orcs and dragons can exist, but people with dark skin, clearly that's a step bridge too far. And that is not, of course, I mean, it's the nerds of color. That's not my problem with either of these shows. My problem is that I just can't stay awake for both of them.
Right. Well, I mean, let's unpack that a little bit. I haven't watched them either recently, and I'd agree with you generally that high fantasy is the part of nerddom that I follow less. And I would say in a very broad way, because it's pretty white, that high fantasy stuff in conception typically and execution, like all the time. So it's a very broad way of saying it, because I'm not trying to disrespect all of various kinds of fans of high fantasy. There are many different kinds of people who love Lord of the Rings and all that shit. But its actual story is a very kind of Eurocentric kind of fantasy, usually.
Like, it's not a coincidence when J.R.R. Tolkien writes about Middle Earth, all of the bad guys come from the East and the South, and they're all dark skinned.
Yeah, yeah. And like,
I and just swarthy.
Yeah, and like this whole bit about like one day we'll restore the glory of the white city, like that. Like, I don't think we would have that line if we remade those.
Gondor has a different connotation in a post-Trump world.
Oh my god, right? Can we just get that white city back? And again, we
make Middle Earth great again.
We knew all these things at the time of watching the movies, but it's just it was a slightly different time. Earlier, and for context, remember those Lord of the Rings movies, let's say they were the hottest ticket a nerddom at the time. Oh,
for sure.
Right?
20 years ago, they were the epitome of nerd culture.
Yeah, they led the charge. There was no Avengers
before
Endgame.
Marvel, right?
They were the Spider-Man movies of...
Yeah, they would be released with extended editions.
Right.
And people would gobble that shit up.
All know about them. So they're a common point of reference.
I love them. I mean, I was saying this earlier. To me, what I'm realizing, particularly Lord of the Rings, it's my appreciation of the stories is diminishing returns because I really love the first two Lord of the Rings movies. Return of the King, I don't love much at all, actually. And then the Hobbit trilogy, I didn't even watch Battle of the Five Armies. Like, yeah. And I didn't love any of those movies. And again, yeah, we get to Rings of Power, but by now I can't even make it past 10 minutes into the first episode. So
wait, but talk about that a little bit more. In your experience of watching not very much of that episode, what were the things that were like, you know, setting you off? Or like,
I think it's just like, you know, the stilted language, and I just can't get into it, right? Like, yeah, the first episode of Rings of Power, so Rings of Power follows Galadriel, who was the Cate Blanchett character in Lord of the Rings, mm-hmm, but like as a teenager. And in fact, the opening minutes of episode one, she's like a child. Hmm. So that's what I mean. Like, I'm not sure what the timeline is, but it's a long ass time ago because Galadriel is like a 10,000 year old elf whatever.
Yeah.
So she's a child in the first...
A light elf, almost, one would say.
But... Right. Sorry. So she's a child in the first episode. And again, I'm it's one of those things. Remember last week I said I can't do two things at once. But I find myself, if I'm watching it and I, like, my attention just starts to drift to my phone.
Yeah.
Right? And then I'm not paying attention to it. And then when I try to put it away, and then my attention drifts to, like, sleeping. And I can't stay awake, and I rewind 10 minutes and then I fall asleep.
Well, I mean, TV shows as a nap inducer facilitator, it's not, you know, that's not without value. I think nap assistance is great.
It's the same thing with House of the Dragon, right? Like, I've actually made it through both of those episodes, but again, in fits and starts, and I have to like be playing a game on my phone while I'm watching it in order to like, because I'm paying more attention to the game on my phone than the TV screen, but at least I make it, maybe the game I'm playing is more interesting, so I'm not falling asleep.
Right.
Like it was with Lord of the Rings. And for all the Tolkien and Martin fans who are listening right now, who were totally pissing off, I am not casting aspersions on the properties themselves. I'm saying this is a me problem.
Oh, well, yeah.
Dominic is the one that's blaming the IP, not me. I'm just, let me get that clear.
A me problem versus a Dominic complaining problem. Look, okay. One thing, I was thinking about Lord of the Rings the other day, and I think it was interestingly, maybe kind of mirroring the angst we're having about the Marvel movies right now, because they were the heights of nerd culture during their
time. Did you like those original ones?
Yeah, no.
So you were a fan.
I watched them and I was into them. I mean, I was always like iffy with the you know, let's fight the dark mud people and the White City thing. But that was just where we were at the time, had to go along with it.
Right.
But then I didn't watch any of those freaking 3-hour Hobbit movies. That was like the falling off point, which to me 100% mirrors this thing that's happening with Marvel right now.
Yeah.
They got to their end game and then they pumped out 15 hours of movie that everyone is kind of And and whether or not there's good parts of that movie, they were no longer like necessary.
Right. Absolutely. And then my thing with The Hobbit is like, I read The Hobbit as a kid, and my memory of that book did not elicit 12 hours of content. And not only that, I didn't even watch Battle of the Five Armies because I was like, there is no way I'm watching a 3-hour R-rated movie based on one paragraph from a children's book.
Yeah. I mean, it just seemed preposterous.
Yeah, exactly.
Yet, as I understand it, Jeff Bezos is a big fan, and perhaps that was part of the impetus for...
I mean, you can't log on to Amazon.com without like a gajillion Lord of the Rings promos.
Right. But, and I'm not sure if I'm going to watch this either. But the stilted language and the set in the high fantasy setting is very constrictive for a lot of audiences, I'll say. And when we have our moment, we took those 3 Lord of the Rings movies, but then we want something else to happen and we want some variation in the, you know, Eurocentric sword quest like dudes motif.
This came a couple weeks ago when we were covering the Dungeons and Dragons trailer. Like, I felt the same way. Like, I was, even though I read The Hobbit as a kid, I didn't read the Lord of the Rings books until I was an adult. Like, when the movies came out is when I read the books, right?
Yeah.
I was not a fantasy. Like, I didn't play D&D. I didn't play Magic the Gathering. I wasn't, like, the closest, I guess, is Zelda, maybe. I played Zelda on the Nintendo, and that was probably, like, the most fantasy I ever got as a kid growing up. Like, it just wasn't my bag. I had friends who loved the shit out of it.
Yeah.
Friends who read Lord of the Rings, like, when we were kids. But to me, it wasn't until... the movies that I gave a shit about Lord of the Rings. Like I said, I read Hobbit as a kid because I think every kid at one point reads The Hobbit. But
most people did. But again, you're speaking of there were two tracks of nerddom at one point. And shout out to my friend Mark Bemister for me. Occasionally listens and who I have this debate with often, which is something about like there's the fantasy track or the science fiction track, you know, it's right. It kind of boils down to swords or lasers, which is cooler. I was pretty much with you. I've also worn the science fiction track, but I did do some Dungeons and Dragons, so I have a base of knowledge in that area. And
which is, which, you know, honestly, I feel like is why Star Wars was such the perfect thing, because it was a blend of both.
Yeah, totally. Good point.
It wasn't hard sci-fi, but it wasn't hard fantasy either, but it took elements of both genres and kind of created its own thing. And that's why Star Wars is this like phenomenon that it is, because it's a fantasy stories with sci-fi tropes, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So I guess that's the third way. You're either a sci-fi nerd, a fantasy nerd, or you become a Star Wars nerd.
Right. Or no, and again, like those two ways shouldn't have to war. They're just too trendy. There is the third way. There is fine. Merging these things is fine. I'm just saying there are those two general tracks, but they don't have to fight. But the way they don't agree on certain aesthetic things is very revealing. Like, is it exciting to see the sword quest the 10th time with another guy in a beard, dragon, great, whatever. Is there any new level to dragon?
Yeah, and you know, and the other thing, I think going back to Game of Thrones or House of the Dragon, the first episode, you know, we didn't get a chance to talk about House of the Dragon on this pod, primarily because it comes out Sunday nights and we record Sunday afternoon. So by the time we talk about, and because I know Brittany is into House of the Dragon, but by the time we talk about the episode, it's actually a week late because, like I said, our recording schedule does not fit with the release schedule of House of the Dragon. That said, again, one of my problems, I think, with the show is that I can't take it seriously, even though I did enjoy most of Game of Thrones for the same reasons. Like, I think it was just compelling storytelling, even if I got over like the bullshit fantasy stuff that I think usually bores me. Mm-hmm. But with House of the Dragon, the thing I was thinking about is the first episode, there's this big joust in the middle of the episode. And over the summer, we had we were hosting a foreign exchange student and we took her to medieval times. And there's a big joust thing in the middle of medieval times. And it's corny as fuck, right? But like watching the joust on screen in House of the Dragon, it just brought me back to like eating a giant turkey leg in an air conditioned space. And I was like, oh, Game of Thrones is just fucking medieval times.
Yeah, true. We can all get behind eating a giant turkey leg. I mean, I'll go on record as saying I don't like Game of Thrones much at all. I was never that into it. But I mean, the amount of love and fandom interest, like, I found very fascinating. So I always thought it was just kind of like slightly better written Spartacus or slightly better written, you know, swords and boobs, basically.
Yeah,
that HBO formula,
that was the pitch, right?
Yeah. And so I think it's fascinating that it's still like going along like a juggernaut. I mean, and I'll tangent say I like George R. R. Martin's other novel series a lot more, Wild Cards, which is more based on superhero shit. And
maybe, that's another track too, right? Because there's like fantasy sci-fi. I think superheroes is almost a third way, because if you don't get into hard sci-fi or hard fantasy, but you follow like Batman comics, you know, where does that lead you?
Right. Well, are superhero people the most hated amongst, like, if you lead to parts where even science fiction and fantasy people think you're weird?
But
that's reversed, maybe. I don't know.
The superhero nerd is who's on top right now. But there was a period where, like you said, 20 years ago when Lord of the Rings came out, the fantasy nerd was on top of the nerd hierarchy.
Yes, definitely the apex nerd.
And I guess the sci-fi, I mean, when was the sci-fi, I guess before, you know, the 60s, 70s, 80s, I think most people associate Trekkies with like ultimate nerddom. So I guess that was the sci-fi nerd, was the predominant nerd stereotype for decades.
I think so. End of the 20th century, definitely sci-fi nerds would be the apex nerds, I think, because of all sorts of things. All nerd things were umbrellaed under the term sci-fi. Right.
Right. So much so that like sci-fi and fantasy kind of got blended together. The SFF got into like its own thing.
Yeah. So yeah.
The warring factions within. Right.
Right. Right. If we're watching the tides, they had control of it because of Star Wars and Star Trek and all those things were prominent. And then fantasy was kind of like the ascension. Lord of the Rings was ascension in the early aughts.
And I guess that kind of coincided with Harry Potter, right? Like, fantasy nerd was the wizards and cloaks was definitely the predominant fandom.
And now the superhero nerd. Now we've defeated you all. I don't know how to sum this up. I mean, I'm sure something else is coming around the bend, but at this moment we win.
Yeah.
But also we're inclusive, except not as much for fantasy. We're inclusive, but like just barely for fantasy.
Yay for us.
Yeah. Oh, where is that going?
Yeah.
Wild Cards is really good. Game of Thrones, not so into it.
Yeah. So that said, what's nerd popping?
What's nerds popping this week? Oh, I just have a short one. Shout out to whoever's writing the Saints Row video games. Shout out to whoever writes the NPC characters in the Saints Row video games, because there's one, you're running around Santiago and there's some random person says, wait, their mothers are both named Martha? And that's it. And you just run fire. So
is that a real thing?
Yeah, there are a lot of jokes like that in Saints Row. And Saints Row is getting a lot of shit, but like some of the writing I think is still very fun and speaks both to Generation X and Generations Y and Z. And I think that's where it's doing well as a written text. On the technical video game level, maybe it's not so.
Yeah, I've seen mixed reviews. And I, to be honest, I hadn't heard about this game until you mentioned it a couple weeks ago. And then when I saw like it kind of like the splash that it made when it was released, I thought about you. And so I wanted to ask you, like, are you enjoying this version of the game? I know that some people have their qualms.
I am, but I have like overcomplicated thoughts about it because it's like, I do see it as like Generation X talking with Generation Z. I don't know if I can summon a good example, but it's
basically... I think that BVS one is a pretty damn good one.
Yeah. I mean, it tries to recast the whole thing as younger, but there's so much Generation X pop culture laden humor behind it. It kind of informs, you know, the characters make some references that they probably wouldn't normally make. Mm-hmm. Again, it's back to like, have today's writers even heard of Ally McBeal? Well, in this case, they're writers who have heard both of Ally McBeal and Megan Thee Stallion. Right. I'll just say, so there's a meeting place there, and I think it's happening in Saints Row. But the basic problem is it's not like graphically as exciting as some of the other games that come out right now.
That's the big complaint. Yeah.
Oh, and so that's just it doesn't fly on YouTube as much as some other products. I'll say one more thing, just relevant to what we were saying. Also, I feel shooter games of the Grand Theft Auto style are trending out of fashion somewhat in the past 8 years for various reasons in favor of there are a lot more high fantasy games. Mm-hmm. So in that field, you know, some Call of Duty guy's going to correct me, but I think apart from the established franchises like Call of Duty, like I think people are trending more towards sword and less towards first-person shooter.
And I guess even a game like Fortnite is so ridiculous and campy that it's not in the same vein as like Grand Theft Auto. And
that's basically what I'm saying. They're right. A campy violence thing has been some parts of things becoming more progressive and conscious and inclusive might be going out of fashion, but right. We will do it cartoonishly. And again, that's where Saints Row kind of sees it is cartoonish. It's silly violence. It's not hyper realistic violence, which used to be a selling point of certain things, but now we're gonna say we don't care that much, or I don't care about it anyway. Yeah. Blah blah blah. How's your nerd popping?
Yeah, so you mentioned Generation X, and I feel like the ascendant nerdom is actually 80s nerd.
Mm-hmm.
More so than superhero, sci-fi, or fantasy. The 80s nerd is who is on top, because the 80s nerd is us, and we're in our 40s and we run shit in Hollywood, and we can make movies and video games that reflect the shit we grew up with. That's why Stranger Things was like the phenomenon that it was. Sure. And in that vein, I watched a movie called Top Gun Maverick this week. Finally, it's been out for several months. And I finally watched it. I caught it on, I didn't watch it in an IMAX theater. I watched it at home because it's now streaming. Mm. It's available for purchase and rental. And I gotta say, I love this fucking movie. Cool. And it goes against everything, right? Like it's jingoistic. It's, again, it elevates like the 60-year-old white guy over everybody else. But goddamn if Tom Cruise isn't a movie star.
Oh, yeah. He's proving that point.
And I mean, I get why this movie made $1 billion. We talked about movies not hitting big at the box office, but this movie made $1.7 billion.
Yep.
And I see why. This is fucking good.
Okay.
Real good. And it's especially good if you like have any kind of reverence for the first one, or any actually memory of the first one. You don't even have to revere the first one. If you like just remember like the score or the Kenny Loggins song. Mm-hmm. And it just tugs on those memory strings.
Again, I haven't seen it, but I've been collecting, you know, anecdotal reviews about it. And I would say you're in the minority of my anecdotal data sets.
So oh, really? Most people hate it?
Most people were not hated it. Most people were not excited about it. A couple people really loved it, and I'm curious why.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of, I guess you can be cynical about it too, right? Because if, again, they know what they're doing, right? It's like, let me, mm-hmm. everything you remember from 1986, here you go. Except now there's like Black and Latino and women pilots. Other than that, mm-hmm. everything is what you remember from the right. first movie. And again, I mean, I'm just a sucker for like nostalgia, I guess, which is a dangerous drug, I understand.
Yes.
But goddamn, if like sometimes that heroin hits yeah. and it makes you feel good, and Top Gun is some like pure cut heroin.
So whoever cooked this batch of Top Gun, you'd say succeeded in hitting.
Well, because here again, I exactly. you know, you mentioned video games. One of my favorite video games when I was a kid on the Nintendo was mm-hmm. the Top Gun video game.
Yeah, right on.
I remember playing that game. I remember how fucking hard it was to land on the aircraft carrier.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's complicated.
So like all of my memories are kind of like baked into that. So again, when you're watching the movie and that score kicks, the Harold Niedermeyer score, I think, like da 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 da, you just can't help like being a little kid. And I think what this movie does, I don't remember the dogfight scenes that well from the first Top Gun movie, or any of the actual like jet scenes, right?
I do. I watched that movie 1,000 times. But go on.
But the mission they go on in this one, I've seen a lot of people compare it to like the trench run in Star Wars. Because they're like, you have to fly low through this cannon yeah. and hit a target like the way Luke hits a target. And you have to like, you know, use the force, Luke. That's actually mm-hmm. a thing that happens in Top Gun. Mm-hmm. And I get that. But I also like, for everyone saying like Top Gun is basically Star Wars, I was like, well, you know, George Lucas, he was influenced by like old World War II dogfight.
Mm-hmm.
So it's definitely. Not, so it's all like cyclical, right? Like people who yeah. whose only context is Star Wars watch this and think, oh, they're ripping off Star Wars, when like Star Wars DNA is like warplanes fighting each other in the air, you know?
Right. But like, so a lot of people were complaining that that last part is the part that gets too off the plan and weird because they don't like name the country.
Right. Right. And I think that's intentional because like the country is essentially the empire. It's like, okay, you don't see, there's no like recognizable insignias on the planes that tells you like it's North Korea yeah. or
and then
Iran.
There's some thing with getting the old plane in. Anyway, I guess people were remarking that it crosses over to absurd at that point.
Yeah, it is. But maybe and the it's, absurd and Star it's Wars awesome. Is
what some people think is awesome.
Yeah,
it's but so some great. People right again, but then like
yeah, because like he gets into an F-14, which were the planes they flew
right.
40 years ago.
Right.
Which again, that is the cynical nostalgia pull.
Yeah. And it's also just completely nuts. It approaches science fiction.
Yeah, which is great. New places. Like, all for it.
Right, but
all just for the ridiculousness of Tom Cruise just being in a jet. I mean, and I will say
this. Yeah, he's 68,000 years old.
Right, exactly. Right. And of course he runs. There's several scenes where he's running. But the technical marvel of the plane scenes in this are amazing. And I do wish I saw it in an IMAX screen because holy shit, like the cinematography is out of this world. So right. I know, again, people may look at me and think I'm corny because I am that like middle America dude who loves him some Top Gun Maverick, but goddamn if that movie wasn't just the perfect, again, heroin for your nostalgia.
No, I mean, because so back to what we're talking about the movie theater industry, and sorry, I'm all about making like the grand
of course
today,
that's
but
what
I
this
think
podcast is for.
That's what I'm talking about. Someone's really happy that one movie, which is an old school sort of military action thriller, not superhero, not science fiction, just starring Tom Cruise, someone's really happy that thank god the non-super movie made $1 billion. We
right.
can still do that. But the people who I talked to who didn't like Top Gun, because it goes into that absurd level where it's almost science fiction movie, that's where they felt betrayed. You know, that's where they lost it. And again, back to that old Top Gun movie, it's had, I'm going to try to pronounce this word correctly, verisimilitude
yes.
of dog being fighting, in the Navy. Fighter planes actually fighting each other. It's had the appearance of being real and not so animated and not so absurd. Now, of course, they have modern technology, so they can sort of split the difference, cut, you know, come to halfway point.
But I mean, but, I don't know, maybe I was blinded by just like, you know, the adrenaline rush of watching the movie, but I didn't think it was that absurd at the end. Like, it doesn't devolve into like the way superhero movies do, devolve into like just CG explosion nonsense at the end, right? Like, there is a whole thing where, like, I mean, without spoiling the movie, Maverick and another pilot have to commandeer an old jet to get back to safety, and then there's dogfights that occur and stuff like that. But nothing is like, one of the technical marvels of this film is that like the actors literally learned how to fly jet planes and film themselves in them, right? So like, and I don't, that's what I mean, I need to go back and watch the original. I don't recall the verisimilitude of the flying scenes in that first movie, but this one puts you in the cockpit, like, yeah, sure. You really do feel like you're, again, going back to like, it tugs on my Nintendo memories as much as anything else, where like you're flying the planes yourself with the Needlemeyer, is that his name? I apologize.
Harold Faltermeyer.
Faltermeyer, that's the yes. Faltermeyer. All of that kind of comes together. So anyway, everyone who thinks I'm corny, I don't care. I'm a corny dad. That's my.
I'm glad that you shared some love and received some joy from.
It was great.
Tom Cruise.
Yes.
I can't shit on that.
The other realization I came to this week is that I never considered myself a Tom Cruise fan. And then I looked at my like Blu-ray movie collection and I was like, holy shit, I own a lot of Tom Cruise movies.
Half of those. Yeah.
And like, I'm trying to think, like, what is a bad Tom Cruise movie?
Cocktail, Far and Away.
Oh, Far and Away. I didn't love Days of Thunder.
Days of Thunder. Do you want me to go on?
Okay, fine.
Never mind. Some of the Mission Impossibles. I'm just making a point.
Most of them are good, though. Mission Impossible.
It's been enough stuff that he has both great movie and crappy movies. He's in that guy who's like every movie.
There's all the real world Scientology shit. I understand. But
he's in that guy who bats 100 for 100. But he's got a decent average.
Yeah. Anyway, how can people find you on the internet, Dominic?
Oh, I'm Dominic Ma. On Instagram or Twitter, I'm Dama, DOMMAH.
Find me on Twitter at TheRealChow, _real_chow, and on Instagram at RealKeithChow. Follow The Nerds of Color at The Nerds of Color. Go to hardknockmedia.com. Find this and all the Hard Knock podcasts. Give us a rating and review on Apple, please. That'll help people find the show. Support us on patreon.com/TheNerdsOfColor. Buy merch at tpublic.com. And find our videos at youtube.com/TheNerdsOfColor. Give us a like and a subscribe. And until next time.
Oh, and also read Murder Club by Cardio Junkie on Archive of Our Own. If you do that kind of thing.